This is Using the Whole Whale, a podcast that brings you stories of data and technology in the nonprofit world. My name is George Weiner, your host and the chief whaler of WholeWhale.com. Thanks for joining us. As a listener of the podcast, by now you're pretty familiar with our obsession with the idea of data culture. The concept that inside an organization we need to understand the data that is associated with our performance, with our impact, and then we actually need to bring it in to the way the organization runs, the way people think, and the way people work. And that's the word culture there. We have a tremendous opportunity today to talk with a guy named Michael Silberman, who is at the Mobilization Lab at Greenpeace. Now that's exciting, especially because it's different, right? When you're at a larger organization, you know, it's all fine and well to like read some new technology or new approach, but you're like, well, you know, not at my organization. We've been around forever and we're stuck in our ways and it's just not gonna happen. Well, this is an interesting conversation because we get to hear directly from Michael about how this mobilization lab inside of Greenpeace, a very large and venerable organization in 55 countries, how they are changing things from the inside, and a lot of echoes of data culture here of how they're helping them adopt different types of technology and the strategies they're doing that actually work and how they're measuring change. So hopefully this gives you some ideas as you listen to Michael's approach. Between sorry and safe is risking a chance at change for the brave. Well, tell me, what do you want to find when you leave your heart behind? I'm here with Michael Silberman from Greenpeace. Michael, how you doing? Tell us, who are you and what do you do?
Hello, George. Yeah, I'm here with the Mobilization Lab at Greenpeace. We are a team of small and mighty team, about four or five people who work with the entire global organization here in almost 55 countries, working to help Greenpeace transition to a new era of campaigning. So we are working to help the organization rewire itself for a modern campaigning landscape.
Yeah, I was going to go into that. Like, what does a mobilization lab do?
Some people have called it a mobiles lab. We are. It's much more than, I guess, what you'd think of as just kind of a traditional, or it's different from what you might think of as a traditional lab or innovation lab, if we're at the point where labs and innovation labs can be traditional. We're pretty deeply embedded with the organization to help facilitate massive organizational change.
Gotcha. And definitely there's like no animal testing in this lab, correct?
Well, you know, at Greenpeace, it's pretty safe to say that no. There were not even baby seals, no.
All right, so we're getting an idea of this. Maybe you can talk through a specific initiative that you led within the organization and how that went to give us a better idea of what you're doing.
Sure. Yeah, I'll tell you about one of the very first things we worked on was helping to kind of catalyze a strong network of mobilization staff and campaigners and people who are focused on engagement to start working together across departments. So I think like many organizations who were around before the internet, we grew up with different departments and teams like fundraising and communications. We had volunteer departments and teams. There's folks who lead the actions. And all these teams are doing great work around the organization. And what we found, though, was that in putting campaigns together, we weren't always getting the best out of everyone. So one of the things we've been working on lately is building a creative facilitation network where project leaders and staff across all the different – anyone who's involved in a project, which is almost – everyone at some point have the skills they need to get the best ideas and the best results out of everyone internally, but then increasingly staff, supporters and activists and folks externally as well. So that's been an exciting exciting series of workshops that are now turning into a self-sustaining network inside the organization of staff supporting one another and figuring out how we can kind of break down a lot of kind of older bureaucratic approaches to campaign planning and start continuing to kind of innovate when we design campaigns so that they're more people-powered and more participatory.
So this is a sort of silo-busting activity to increase communication, to increase creativity. Can you talk us through some of the tactics and maybe some of the tools that you're using in order to do this inside of a large organization?
Sure. Lots of post-it notes. That's first. That's our big technology. We're pulling from a few different practice areas like design thinking and kind of open source technology principles. And some of the, you know, some of what we see when we work with folks on this is just lots of idea generation. So, you know, I think we found that many meetings you go to here, but in many other organizations are either partially scripted or there's not enough room or time for people to contribute their best thinking, or people don't know how, or people organizing meetings don't know how to facilitate that or get the or create the space for people to generate many ideas or approaches to something. So part of what we're starting to see now through these creative leadership processes and workshops are people from across the organization who wouldn't normally maybe even think that they have the ability to participate in that core business of campaigning, able to contribute ideas and fresh perspectives that didn't otherwise get counted.
Interesting. So it's as much an approach and training as it is necessarily like a quick trick. It may be hard, I guess, for you to measure progress for cultural change, as it sounds like. What are some of the leading indicators that you're looking for, the signs? You mentioned meeting structure. How are you measuring success as you move forward through this project?
Sure. Yeah, this has been a tricky question for us from the beginning. And we talked to a bunch of folks about how do you do, there's a whole monitoring and evaluation world of practice area that I discovered, especially strong in the international development spaces. But the, you know, measuring organizational change is tricky, we discovered. So what we're looking at, and it's not very scientific, or people haven't just figured out the silver bullet to doing that. We're good at measuring campaign outcomes, but less so the evolution of an organization. And so what we're focused on is seeing where the seeds that we've planted, different practices that we've introduced, the ways of working that we've introduced, to see where those are sticking. And so where are we seeing, to stick with some environmental analogies, because we're here at Greenpeace, where are seeds taking root? Where are things becoming mainstreamed in the organization? And I'll give you one example of that, which is, you know, we started as a team of, again, four to five people a couple years ago, doing a lot of capacity building and training, supporting this global network of staff who work with supporters and are working on engaging supporters. And now, as a result of some various restructuring at the international organization, we're looking at a team of nearly 40 people internationally who are going to, with the international body, the coordinating body, who will be supporting staff globally now. So that's the kind of stuff that we track and identify as, okay, we now have a more permanent thing. We've piloted a bunch of things to support staff. Now we have a permanent body at the international coordinating level to support this network.
So as you're looking at the ripple effect of your work, what are some of the things that could be seen potentially on the ground in the day-to-day activities where, you know, Greenpeacers are working, let's say, on campaigns or fundraising? What does your work look like once it's reached the implementation stage for teams that are in the field?
Sure. I can think of a couple examples right now where we have campaigns at the planning stage, which are inviting supporters into the process, which are testing their campaign plans with folks. And not just, I don't mean just kind of polling or seeing, you know, do you like this or not, but actually co-creating plans and talking with people who are going to be most directly impacted, who are most directly impacted by certain issues that we might be tackling, bringing them into the campaigning process. There's some in the detox campaign and the oceans campaigns globally, where we're starting to see a very different approach to campaign planning as well as to implementation. So on the planning side, a lot more openness, a lot more interest in figuring out how we get more people's ideas into the mix. And on implementation, we're seeing more and more campaigns rolling out, and we could talk about some where we have more roles for more people to participate in the work or to scale and grow the work. So whether it's using citizen science, people, you know, contributing their own intel to a campaign to make it stronger, or their own time or expertise on the ground to organize, campaign, and basically accelerate a campaign's ability to win.
Sounds like a before and after would look like, you know, more leveraging of the wisdom of crowds internally, tapping into more creative sources. That, I'm sure, leads to greater impact. I'm going to go really quickly just back, and you were saying that it seemed like one of the successes was changing a meeting structure. Now, that seems like kind of boring, but also having myself sat through a lot of incredibly dull, sometimes way too long nonprofit meetings. Like, help me. What are your, you know, cheat sheet for making a meeting suck less?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you the example of the bigger meetings we organize. We have spent, you know, each of the past few years, we've organized a big Skillshare. This year, we just organized an open campaigning camp a couple of weeks ago in Berlin. We have another one coming up on mobiles for mobilization. And we almost always partner with our colleagues at Aspiration, who are real kind of world pioneers in the participatory event model. And so it all comes back to figuring out, like I said, how do we get the most out of everyone, right? So I think what happens with most of the meetings that the meetings that we all leave and say, wow, that was boring, or that was terrible, and I didn't do anything useful in that, or all I did was email the whole time. I traveled around the world just to do a bunch of emails. I think that's the result of, in most cases, it's meeting design, right? And not knowing how to figure out how do we get everyone's brains active. And so what we do with the meetings that we organize and the Skillshares, and increasingly this is the case across Greenpeace, is we, you know, minimize plenary time. We minimize small groups of talking heads who may have everything figured out and just need a platform to communicate, because there's lots of other mediums for doing that, right? You can email those things around. You can do a webinar. You can have people, you can record yourself, and you can have people, you can do the broadcast thing in a lot of different ways. But when you have a group of people together, that's an incredible amount of potential energy and potential intelligence that I think is, you know, it's almost a crime or malpractice or something to not harness that. And so with more participatory events, like the one we just had in Berlin, this open campaigns camp, you're looking at events that where the majority of the time you have sessions and discussions organized by the participants themselves. So you can even go so far as to source the agenda from participants to figure out what's going to be, rather than a small group of individuals saying, here's what's going to be most important for this much larger group. You have an entire 80 people or however big your meeting is surfacing the priorities and leaning in to design content sessions and outcomes oriented discussions that move the discussion forward for everyone, not just based on a limited view of what a couple of people may think is most important for everyone else.
Gosh, an 80 person meeting sounds more like a mini conference to me than a meeting.
Yeah, but it works, man. It's that's great.
Fair enough.
A lot of fun.
All right. So, how long have you been?
Sorry, the key thing there is you're limiting. It's rare that you would want 80 people ever all together in the same room, because I think that's where. And so there is something about meeting size. When you ask about tips and tricks, you know, a meeting of 12 people, there's, in almost any time you have more than, five people around a table, you want to get people into smaller groups. So that's what I mean by all those sessions are happening concurrently. You might have 10 or 12 different sessions happening at a group of 80. But I think it's the same principle. If you're organizing a meeting with 20 people in the room for a campaign plan, you're not going to get, you know, you can waste a lot of time either having one person talk or trying to get 20 different going around in circles and having a UN-style meeting where each person gives a mini speech. And instead, I think what we've found is there's many better tools and techniques for getting people to individually or in smaller groups work together to generate, you know, ideas, concepts, or hash out questions.
Yeah, the meeting size seems like a critical ingredient. You know, every person you add after seven, as like, you know, the Microsoft Innovation Labs and other people say, mm-hmm. every new person you add there literally brings down the productivity and efficacy of the working group. So good to hear that you're not running 80-person meetings.
No, God, no.
I feel like you'd have negative return on that.
That would be scary, yeah.
So how long have you been in this role at Greenpeace?
Funny you ask. I just realized on my way to work today that I have passed the my 4-year anniversary as of August 1.
Happy anniversary. You did
well,
it.
Well, thank you.
You did it.
Good.
All right. So let's say we could jump in the hot tub time machine because we're celebrating your 4-year mm-hmm. and bring the wiser, sharper, more brilliant Michael back and speak to that guy 4 years ago that was starting this job. What is something that you would do differently or advise yourself to do differently as you approach the role?
Gosh. Killer question. I think going into this, we were fortunate that you know it was understood from the outset that there was not a perfect recipe for success here, right? That we were, you know, one of the benefits of the design of the model here, this lab or center of excellence as it was termed internally, was that it was going to have the freedom to experiment and innovate. And I don't think one of the lessons we learned as a team when we reflected last year, at the end of last year, about what we've learned, we realized there's not a direct correlation between the time we spend on things and the impact it has. So for example, we could spend 4 months planning a boot camp or a training with a specific office, going deep, and while it may have had some great impact, we may have seen even better results from someone who came to a Skillshare or an event and, you know, was part of a session for 15 minutes that we were in or something, and they went home and transformed their office. And, you know, that 1 hour, 15 minutes had as much, if not more, impact on that office than the entire, you know, than the 4 months and the blood, sweat, and tears we poured into developing a boot camp. So all that to say, I think I would place an even greater emphasis on having multiple pots cooking, and at the same time, because you just don't know sometimes which of the stews is going to turn into something that bears fruit. So we planted lots of different seeds, and some have grown into blossoming trees faster, and others have taken more time despite what we would have predicted. So I think if I went back and did it again, I would create even more ways to allow more things to grow.
It seems like when you're looking back retrospectively, mm-hmm. you know, your highest yield wins come from when you find an internal champion, change their mind or inform them and have them go back and then change it from within the inside, as opposed to, you know, sitting everyone down and speaking over their heads. That internal change maker seems critical to some of the faster changes you've seen. Is that a safe analysis?
Yeah, our work relies on change agents that exist internally or that we can support and build. We are enablers. We are not, it is impossible to, I think, do the kind of work we're doing and expect that we can do that stuff ourselves. And that's, so I think you're absolutely right. And that's baked into our design. They, you know, initially there was the leadership of the organization was smart and prescient and saying, you know, we're not just going to hire one or two people to sit at our international body and just generate new things and challenge us and push us. And, they say, you know, we need to create a space that's going to be able to sit at the edges and work with the innovators that already exist in the organization, support them, amplify them, build them up. And, you know, so we took much more of that organizing approach that you're describing, in terms of building a community of practice, enabling people who are already on the leading edge of change internally, but aren't being acknowledged for that, and giving them a platform, a home, a space to continue doing that and to help them, you know, make their work that become the norm.
So I'm going to tap into some of your broader knowledge, which you've been modest about sharing, but, you know, you've had entire other lives where you founded pretty impressive technology companies. You're running helping run the Web of Change conference back when it first started. I'm curious about your advice to other nonprofits tackling digital impact. You know, what is some of your advice to those folks that know they need to make some internal change before they can just, you know, start using Periscope?
My advice is for organizations to really step back and figure out, why do people matter to what they're doing? What's so exciting about digital right now is that it's enabling participation in at scales we've never seen before, right? The access, the cost is so low for anyone to be able to lead and drive change and initiate change and raise money and organize. And we're seeing that in these emergent social movements everywhere. For organizations, whether it's Greenpeace or anyone else, I think we have some clarity here about why people matter, but it's even for an organization that is focused on mobilization and engaging more and more people to participate in these giant campaigns that we can't win on our own. I think it's the same question for many other groups. And if you're trying to dive into digital, you know, you can chase many balls and get distracted by all kinds of shiny things that are exciting. And Periscope is exciting, and it is transformative in lots of different ways. But until you know why people matter, and at the deepest level, why you should spend all that extra time and energy and find that expertise to be engaging and empowering people in deeper, deeper ways, I think it's really hard for organizations to go the distance, right? To go the distance to become effective until they have the religion, so to speak, right, of people power, if that's where they're going.
To summarize, it seems like you're saying start with why. Why are we doing this? Why will it matter? And have that internal conversation.
I think that's right. Because, the people who seem to struggle, you know, I think the people who are kind of frustrated because all they're doing is building, you know, all they can find themselves doing is building big email lists or doing, you know, petition-based activism alone. You know, that has its place. But if that's where the train ends, I think those are the organizations and the digital directors who are getting frustrated because they're still having that discussion with the rest of their staff about why digital and the people who are engaging through digital are more than just fundraising leads or more than just a vanity metric that they can put up on the website.
I really appreciate the sort of larger advice and the reflection you've done here. Final question here for you is, you know, what is something you think you or your organizations should stop doing? You know, we're always so busy with, well, let's do more. And now you're like, oh, yeah, I remember Periscope. I got to go, you know, sign up and go screw with that. But what is something, you know, that is on your list and maybe your organization's list for a stop doing?
Yeah, I think I think we need to stop letting the tools define our strategy. And I don't think anyone would explicitly say that's what they're doing, but I think what's increasingly happening is, as all the, you know, the databases and website tools and action tools get more sophisticated and commoditized, and staff become really good at using them all and comfortable using those, it gets harder and harder to think about strategies from a blank slate and to think about how do we use the constellation of technology and tools that are out there to do something clever, do something new, do something that's going to be remarkable or really engaging or exciting or powerful and impactful for the campaign we're doing. And I remember having a conversation very recently with Zach Exley, one of the early guys at MoveOn, who would say, you know, when they were talking about event tools, right, they weren't talking about event tools. They just thought about what would be most effective for this next step in the campaign. And they had a bunch of people who they thought they wanted to invite to participate in something locally. And so they built themselves in, you know, 24 hours, the technology that they needed to get people out or to invite people to take action locally. And I think often we're missing that moment in our campaign planning where we say, what if we do this or let's do that because it could be the most creative strategic thing we can do. And instead are saying, well, we can either send a letter to the, we can ask people to do a letter to the editor, or we can do a petition because that's what the tool, or a donation ask because those are the three things my tool set allows me to do. So I think we need to stop limiting ourselves, limiting the potential of our organizations and our creativity by the available tools and technology that's out there.
Yeah, I love that as a sort of takeaway, and also good to hear that you didn't just run into your job and say, all right, everybody, we're all using Yammer now, or we're all using Slack now. I've solved it.
Check.
I can move on. Are you guys using either of those?
You know, Slack is getting hot right now among some communities here. Skype remains very big. No big signs of life on Yammer yet here, though.
Yeah. Well, Slack is much cooler. Is that a sort of, you know, is that high on your list of like, hey, this is interesting and taking a look at it?
Yes, we've been playing with it as the Mob Lab team, and some of the technologists around the organization, as you can imagine, have jumped to it more quickly and see the benefits and efficiencies. But man, we are an email, you know, email still works really well, especially for those people who are in far-flung places of the planet with limited internet connections. And it's that interesting question of when you have a real diverse set of users and people, what's going to work? And how do we not isolate subgroups of people who are, you know, the people who are privileged by high speed internet access and in front of their desks all day, and find things that are going to work for those organizers in the field who are with patchy internet connections. And even if they have a smartphone, the thing that's going to come in best for them is a text message or an email. So
yeah. No, but it's important to note like who and the diversity of who you're talking with and the mediums that work for them, right? So one size rarely fits all, and
yeah,
you know, I think you have a good good balance on how to do that, and certainly Greenpeace is a massive organization that's helping you see that. As we move to a close here, Michael, thanks for joining us. How do people find you, and you know, how might someone help you?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for the the opportunity to plug. Yeah, mobilizationlab.org, and that is the British or international spelling of mobilization, so that is with an S instead of a Z or a Z, depending on where you're listening from. And we are constantly on the lookout for innovations in people-powered campaigning. I should say case studies, just real stories of things people have tried that worked, didn't work, organizational transformation or ways to engage more people in our work. And those are things that we are trying to cover and share as best we can. And if folks have those stories that need to get told, we would love to hear about them and help get those shared and told.
Awesome. And then on Twitter, how do people get you?
Yeah, I am Silbatron on Twitter, and we are Mobilization Lab on Twitter as well.
Well, great. Thank you for your time. I'm sure you've got a lot more to get back to work on, so take care and good luck.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it.
Michael was super generous to share his experience in changing things inside of Greenpeace, and now you know all the secrets. We're done, we can go home. Well, maybe not, but at least you can get an idea of, you know what, it's not easy for everybody. Here's an organization that certainly has the resources, but this is their approach. They're going one by one. They're trying, you know, meeting structures and trainings, and changing things internally can be hard. But there are some seeds there, to once again grow that analogy. There are some seeds you can play with. We talked about some technical platforms that you may not have been familiar with. So if you're scratching your head about Periscope, that is the live streaming sort of mobile-focused service that Twitter launched recently. You can try it out. Don't waste too much time on it, though. And Slack is kind of like the anti-email and more effective chat, but it allows you to organize things a lot better and have conversations inside of your organization internally. Again, play with it, Be careful, though, because sometimes it can be a bigger detriment. I think it's more effective for decentralized teams that are maybe working across different offices. We haven't adopted Slack for Whole Whale, but, you know, hope springs eternal. Maybe we'll go for it. As a final takeaway, you know, we'll be listing some of these resources, as always, on wholewhale.com/podcast. Take care. This has been Using the Whole Whale. For more resources on today's show, please visit wholewhale.com/podcast and consider following us on Twitter @wholewhale. And thanks for joining us. As always, our intro and outro music by the debonair Greg Thomas Band. And the music you heard in the middle of the cast was by a band called Silence Is Sexy. Check them out.